Hi, and I realized something in the middle of a recent night, something that passes in my brain at least for a eureka moment. Now, prepare to be underwhelmed. I realized that I don't have to say at the beginning of every podcast, "Hi, it's Patrick here." I could just say hi or hello or just hurtle headlong into some lingua podding. In this week's pod, the national anthem of Belize gets a rendering in the local Creole language. Belizean Creole isn't highfalutin, but it does bind the country's diverse peoples together. And Stephen Fry on his new TV documentary series, Planet Word.
Without this extraordinary thing in language, tense, we couldn't have got anywhere, because tense allows you to say what we're going to do tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow. Or it allows one person to say to another person, do you remember that thing we saw yesterday, three sunsets ago? That place there. Let's meet there in four sunsets time. That's immediately a plan, and it's immediately an enormous saving on calories, which is what nature is all about.
The World in Words podcast and the World Radio Programme, The Big Show, are both co-productions of the BBC World Service, PRI, Public Radio International, and WGBH radio station here in Boston. Online, The Big Show is at theworld.org. This podcast is at theworld.org/language. I also post notes at patrickcox.wordpress.com. I'm on Twitter, PATRICOX, Patrick Cox, and on Facebook, at the World in Words page. Most of today's pod is going to be devoted to the Creole that's spoken in Belize, which is in Central America. It's richly multilingual. The Creole, like many other Creoles around the world, is low status, but people speak it. It's a bridge language for people who don't understand each other's native tongues. Also, a conversation with the always entertaining Stephen Fry about his TV series on language. First, though, this.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC.
Domo, Mac desu.
Konnichiwa, Pasokon desu. Saikin ja iroiro kyoutsuu te aru yo ne.
Oi, eu sou o Mac.
E eu, PC. Eu curto fazer coisas divertidas.
You know the ads. And they were on all over the world, it seems. Just like those other products that were dreamed up by Steve Jobs and the people around him. This podcast is sort of everywhere, too. As much as iTunes is everywhere. It doesn't even matter what your native tongue is. You can download it and listen. Now, I come out of radio broadcasting, which of course tends to be city or country specific, like The Big Show is only broadcast in the US and Canada, maybe a couple of other places, but we don't track it. And that's why I get such a kick out of uploading this piece of audio that goes up once a week that can be downloaded anywhere in the world. The fact that the things that we talk about in the pod are utterly global just makes it better. We, all of us, globally, we're just at the start of this conversation, this exchange of ideas and thoughts. Now, I'm not saying that Steve Jobs alone made that happen. He didn't. He didn't invent the internet. He didn't invent podcasting. But his company popularized it way beyond our imagination. Now, here's another totally different example of a set of words and ideas that, because of Apple technology, became so much more broadly disseminated. Calestous Juma, who's now a Harvard professor, he was one of the first Africans to use a Macintosh computer. That was back in 1984. He was a grad student in the UK. He took his Mac back to his native Kenya, and he started experimenting with desktop publishing and typesetting. And it really took off, as he told The Big Show's Marco Werman.
My wife and I set up a company that was providing typesetting services. And we were typesetting for publications that were calling for democratic change. So new magazines would become available that were pushing for democracy that could only have been made available at that time through desktop publishing.
So given the publications, the type of publications you were putting out, what do you think were the political implications of those? And obviously you can trace that back to the Mac.
Yes, I give an example. Exactly 21 years ago, we published a book called Constitutional Development in Kenya. It was the first book that was widely distributed that started to raise debates around what kind of constitution the country actually needed. And that book generated extensive debates in the country. The person who wrote it, Professor J.B. Ojuang, is now one of the five members of the Supreme Court, the new Supreme Court of Kenya. He has lived through a period of democratic change, played a very important role, became a figurehead. And I think the book had a great impact in amplifying his ideas in the wider community.
I'm wondering, Calestis, when you heard of the death of Steve Jobs, what you thought. Did you feel that, wow, thanks to him, all of this was possible for me in Africa?
The first thought that crossed my mind when I heard it was that his inner light has shone on almost every person I can think of, and that is not going to go away. He's opened people's eyes to the possibility of taking technologies that already exist without having to invent a lot of new things and give them a new purpose.
Calestis Juma, Professor of International Development at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Another little coincidence here. I was asked by PRI just this week to promote its app for the iPhone and its Android app too. How about that? Just this week. Well, both apps are free to download. You can get them at the iTunes App Store or at Google Android Market or at PRI.org. Okay, coming up, we have an interview with Stephen Fry. Stephen Fry, for anyone who doesn't know him, he's a Renaissance man. He's an incredibly gifted jack of all trades. He's been a comedian, an actor, a novelist, a TV personality, a public figure with opinions, a tech head, a tweeter. A few years ago, he dabbled in podcasting. And that's when I first found out that he had this deep interest in language. He read books by serious thinkers like Guy Deutscher and Steven Pinker. And then in his podcast, he mused about them and related them to his own life more intelligently or entertainingly than, frankly, most of us do. So I was very excited to find out that he was doing a five-part TV documentary series on language. It's called Planet Word.
Hello. You know, just saying that one word is one of the most complex and extraordinary operations we know. 70 muscles and 500 million brain cells go into it. And what's more, pretty much anyone who can speak English over the age of 2 can do it without even having to think. The story of language is surely one of the greatest stories we have.
This is on TV in Britain right now, on the BBC. I hope it makes its way over here to the US. I imagine that it will in some form or other. I watched the first part, which is mainly about how we acquire language and develop creativity. And Fry does a nice job of incorporating the personality of Stephen Fry into a discussion about word acquisition. Listen here as he hears from Steven Pinker, then morphs into an old TV comedy sketch of his.
Right from the beginning, from the time at which children first start putting two words together, some of those combinations are clearly from their own creativity. An example, a child who had whose hands were covered with jam and wanted the mother to wash them. The mother washed off the jam. The child said, "All gone sticky." Now, that's doesn't correspond to any adult English sentence, but the child had those two words and had the formula that put them in that order to express the idea of passing of a state.
Our language, Tiger, our language, hundreds of thousands of available words, trillions of legitimate new ideas, so that I can say the following sentence and be utterly sure that nobody has ever said it before in the history of human communication. Hold the newsreader's nose squarely, waiter, or friendly milk will countermand my trousers. Perfectly ordinary words, but never before put in that precise order. A unique child delivered of a unique mother.
And now here's Stephen Fry talking about his Planet Word series with the BBC's Sarah Montague. And there's mention of John Humphreys, who is another BBC interviewer who has some, how shall I put it, old-fashioned views on the English language. Here's Sarah Montague.
Our language, of course, continues to change, and we should not be afraid to change it ourselves. At least so says Stephen Fry in the foreword to the book which accompanies the series, and he's here with me in the studio.
Hello.
Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
You're not surely suggesting we make up new words, are you?
Yes, new words are made up all the time, and that's how language develops and grows. And with the greatest respect to your colleague, Mr. Humphreys, who spends a lot of his spare time, such as it is, writing books telling us that language is going to the dogs, I don't think anyone who understands language, or anyone at least in the academic field of linguistics, or neurolinguistics, or psycholinguistics, or all the various villages of linguistics that have developed in the way that they do in academia, would believe for a second that that is a way of looking at language. There's never been a stable language.
What John typically objects to, Americanisms coming in, or in fact...
No, this is absurd. You see, this is like, it's like food, yes. We may dislike a bland wash of colas and burgers coming in and destroying our England, but at exactly the same time, our language is being totally enriched by flavours from the East and by flavours from Africa and Thailand and so on.
Flavours from computers as well.
And indeed from all kinds of discourse. And the idea that it is just a sort of bland American is nonsense.
But we on this programme, perhaps it's a virtue in some ways, have to be slightly stuck in the mud with the way we, for example, present bulletins. We're not necessarily...
Words are freighted. If someone claims something or someone states something, it's very different. And if you've decided to use the word claim as opposed to the word state, then that person might be affronted because they may say that there's an element of doubt in the way you've presented it. People forget that the process of language is, Taz and Fraser, a two-way street, but as my mouth is moving at the speed at which it is moving and words are coming out without me really having to line them up in a queue and check them and see that their teeth are polished and that their nails are clean, they just simply stream out of my mouth, as they do out of yours every morning, without you really having consciously to think. It's an automatic process, and yet what you are saying is immensely important and can offend people and can become a news story. So somehow there's this self-monitoring going on. But don't forget that the person listening is doing just as miraculous a thing. They are hearing sound waves coming in and rattling their ears, and it is taking on a huge meaning in their brain, which somehow is consonant to the meaning in your brain. And we can be 1,000 miles away while this is happening. Language is simply, it seems to me, totally underestimated.
Well, that brings me on to the fact that this series, in a way, one sense, it's a very obvious thing to do, and yet people haven't done it recently.
No, they've become obsessed with trying to get chimps to press buttons or see if they're, some sort of monkey or corvine, like a raven, can solve a problem. But communication, it seems to me, when you learn a language at school as opposed to acquiring a language as a normal person, you come across things like tenses, and the future tense and the past tense, and you don't really think about them. But actually, without this extraordinary thing in language, tense, we couldn't have got anywhere, because tense allows you to say what we're going to do tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow. Or it allows one person to say to another person, do you remember that thing we saw yesterday, 3 sunsets ago? That place there. Let's meet there in 4 sunsets' time. That's immediately a plan. And it's immediately an enormous saving on calories, which is what nature is all about. Instead of having to sort of improvise like a wolf pack, how are we going to do it, by instinct, you actually set out a plan and then implement it. And it underwrites everything that is our civilization language.
Well, wonderful communicator you are, Stephen Fry. Thank you very much.
I wish I could be here longer to confuse you.
OK, now Belizean Creole. And Belize, this autumn/fall, has been celebrating its independence from the British, which took place 30 years ago. And they've been singing this a lot, the national anthem.
Oh, land of the free by the Carib Sea, our manhood we pledge to thy liberty. No tyrants here linger, despots must flee.
So, English is the language of the national anthem. It's also the country's official language. But it isn't actually the mother tongue of most Belizeans. There are several mother tongues, among them Belizean Creole, which also serves as the link language among the various linguistic groups there. This Creole has its roots in several West African languages, as well as English, with a couple of other languages thrown in. Amy Bracken is here to talk about that right after we hear her story about a new Belizean Creole version of the national anthem. You may have heard Amy's reports on the big show out of Haiti. She's reported from there for us a bunch of times. She's clearly drawn to places where there's a vibrant Creole language. Here's her story, which focuses on the woman behind the Creole version of the Belize national anthem.
If you go down a path behind a tool and parts shop in Punta Gorda, you'll likely find Lila Vernon sitting in her garden. Lila Vernon is a household name in Belize. She's known as the Queen of Bruckdown. It's a popular rural Belizean dance music. She's won awards from the government of Belize and the Queen of England, promoting her culture at home and abroad.
It's me right here. When I went to Germany.
She's also known for her protest songs.
Blackness in the sunrise, we are out in the fields, absorbed by our masters so we won't flee. We tile from the dawning.
Vernon is now 60. She likes to talk about her hobbies, organic gardening and canning, but she hasn't given up writing songs. In fact, she's been tinkering with a national anthem.
O land of the free by the Caribbean Sea, with courage we pledge to make you free. No tyrants can stay when no enemies are for go. From this a peaceful place of democracy. I shouldn't say alpha, I should say ah.
Belize's national anthem is called Land of the Free. The lyrics were written by a Belizean soldier, Samuel Alfred Haynes, in 1963. Haynes fought for the British in World War I, but soon after led a riot protesting racism at home. When Belize gained independence in 1981, his song became the new country's anthem. But the song is in a formal English, so a few years back, Vernon decided to translate Haynes' words into Creole.
So I'm doing this for my ethnic people here in Belize, mainly, so that they could understand what, you know, what is going on, what went on, why we're celebrating.
Belizean Creole is a mix of English and African languages. And the Creole here transcends ethnicity. It's spoken by the Garifuna, three Mayan tribes, Mestizos, Mennonites, East Indians, and Chinese, as well as ethnic Creoles.
When you come to Belize, the first thing you need to understand that the Creole language binds all the ethnic people together here. And they have to speak Creole so that they can communicate with another group. You know, so that makes the whole thing unique, very unique.
Vernon says after independence, school children sang Land of the Free just as they had sung God Save the Queen under British rule, with little thought or understanding.
I personally, you know, used to sing the anthem, but I didn't pay much attention to the words, you know, until after translating it to Creole, then I said, but this is a very serious protest song.
The final verse of the song says, freedom will come tomorrow afternoon.
Meaning that we are not free yet. You know, that got to me. That really, you know, that got to my brain. And I say, oh, when will we be free then? Until tomorrow afternoon. That means we are still under the whip then, in other words. No, but just a gesture, you know. We make our decision for ourselves. It all depends on what you think about freedom.
I ask her if the Belizean people are free now. She says yes, but they also live in poverty, and she blames the legacy of British colonial rule for that.
But I do believe the rippling effect of slavery is taking a toll in Belize.
She's referring to a recent rise in violence in Belize City. She says her country needs economic opportunities, but she also believes in the power of embracing one's culture.
We can start again?
Okay.
Sure. Wait, just because we're for Obama,
ready?
For The World, I'm Amy Bracken.
Okay, and so the reporter of that piece, Amy Bracken, is here. How much of Belizean Creole did you find yourself understanding?
Actually, very little. I'm embarrassed to say I was in Belize for about 2.5 months, and I found it very difficult to learn. And I was surrounded by a number of languages, also Garifuna and at least one Mayan language, Kekchi. But there's something about going from English, as an adult, going from English to English Creole that's particularly challenging because of the closeness I found. I was speaking to my Garifuna teacher when I was in Belize, and he was trying to teach me some Creole, and he said he had talked to a number of other Anglophones from outside of Belize, and he said that there is this certain block. And part of it is that you feel like you're putting on a funny accent, or you're just sort of putting on airs, you're speaking differently, it's like you're impersonating a different kind of person speaking the same language. And there are things like
boy in Creole is boy. And it sounds a little bit like what I would associate with sort of Southern 1950s speak in the U.S., and it sounds almost derogatory, like the people call each other boy all the time, boy. And so it's just, I was very uncomfortable with it, and so it was hard to move beyond things like that.
Right, because it's so close to English, it almost could sound to your ears and mine like a form of slang, like a form of street talk, which it is not.
Exactly. And sometimes that's the way it felt. Sometimes it sounded like a completely different language. And I think if I were to slip into complete fluency, it would be something else. And I knew a Peace Corps volunteer who was down there. She was working in a little village, and she had to take an intensive Creole class, and she was able to really grasp it and do well with it. But I think that sort of in that middle stage, it's very challenging.
Mm. Did you see examples of it written down with newspapers or newsletters or any kind of, aside from this particular dictionary that you've come to the studio with today?
Just a little bit. There was one column in one of the main newspapers that was in Creole, and I think that had only been around for a few years. And then text messaging. I found that texting, it was very easy to do that in Creole, I think, because a lot of the words are shorter and the phrases are sort of simpler in a way.
And in the text, is there a stable spelling?
No. Well, actually, because most of my exposure was actually in text messaging. I mean, in the English that I'm used to, you see all different kinds of spelling, too.
That's true.
Because it's sort of phonetic or it's shortened. But Creole is a phonetic and shortened version anyway. And it's such an alive language, too. Because I'm only familiar with one actual Creole dictionary, I don't know how many different kinds of official spellings are out there. I'm familiar with the French Creole language, which just recently became written as well, and there are so many different dictionaries with different spellings for things, so I sort of assume that it's the same with...
The French Creole being...
In Haitian Creole, yeah.
Haitian Creole. What I mean. So what kind of status does this language have if it barely makes it into the newspaper?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, so I was speaking with this woman, Lila Vernon, who just translated the anthem into Creole for the first time. The anthem had already been translated into Garifuna, which is this very small population. I mean, it makes up like 4 or 5% of the Belizean population, and it's seen as a dying culture and a dying language.
That's an indigenous language?
Well, it's a mix of Amerindian, Arawak, and Carib with West African languages, but mostly Amerindian, and it's a population that's in Belize and Guatemala and Honduras and Nicaragua. Because there's been such an effort to preserve the language, there's a sort of fascination. People are excited about it. They see it as a very distinct language, and it is very different from what most people in that area have ever heard before, really. So unlike Garifuna, Creole is not seen as an at-risk or a dying language. In fact, it's quite the opposite. A lot of people feel like it's sort of threatening their languages, that Kekchi Mayan people are afraid that their kids are growing up speaking Creole rather than Kekchi Mayan, as well as the case with Garifuna.
Yeah, so it's like one of those invasive species that, you know, some kind of fish that nobody will actually eat, but it's eating all the other fish in the river.
That's a really good comparison, yeah. And, well, I mean, I think it's maybe, it doesn't need defending because it's so invasive, but because it's seen as sort of the base language, the language of the uneducated people, and that, I mean, it can be a bridge language for people, and a lot of people speak another language. But for people who only speak Creole, some people sort of feel like they've been made to feel ashamed that it's their main language. So I think as a result, and I saw this in Haiti as well, that a lot of people will sort of pretend to speak the language of the educated. Like, a lot of people will feel like they should understand English completely. And what I learned doing the story about the anthem is that a lot of people never understood what they were singing. They grew up singing the anthem, and they never understood it, and they just sort of would carry on with that sort of pretense.
Right. And presumably when they come across you, an outsider, native English speaker, they're going to be redoubling their effort to sound as proper as possible, right?
Yeah, and I think it could be, I was often fooled in the beginning because people could speak, they could sort of slip very easily from Creole into what sounded like very good, clear English, or the English that I'm familiar with. And then, but I would realize that a lot of the time they wouldn't understand me because they might be very good at an English with a certain kind of vocabulary or a certain set of words. So there were a lot of words that that people didn't understand. And sometimes if they were comfortable enough with me, they would tell me that they wouldn't understand. And I, you know, maybe I could feel equally ashamed of not speaking their language as they were of not speaking mine.
Well, maybe you can give me a couple of examples of words that would have stumped you.
Oh, no. I have to really feel ashamed of not speaking Creole.
Well, I'm sure there are words that would stump me if their source is, you know, a West African language.
Well, I think actually, I mean, it's tough to say because a lot of the words are just very simple words. So words that will indicate if something's past tense or future, or on is always pawn. You put something pawn the table, you call me pawn my phone. So you just get thrown by these things that, yeah, if it's spelled out or said slowly, then you might understand it. And then there were a lot of words. Lila Vernon was walking me through some of the words of African origin. And when I say African origin, I mean there's from so many different languages in Africa, particularly West Africa. So, for example, if somebody wants to say you have big feet, you have a pair of big feet, they say, what a pete you have, like, meaning in Creole, pete comes from the Igbo. So English, it's just a pair of big feet. Another word that comes from Igbo is the word for children, which you hear a lot, pikni, which comes from the Igbo pikini.
And there's a similar one in Jamaican patois, right? Pikni. Doesn't that also mean children? I don't know, but it comes up an awful lot.
Yeah, I feel like I heard it an awful lot before I went to Belize, but I don't know. And then uno, which comes up in the Creole, it's sort of a call to all of you. It's you all. It comes from Igbo una.
And Igbo is from originally, where, Nigeria?
Yeah, what's now Nigeria. It's one of the big languages there. And so that's had a big influence. I mean, a lot of people talk about they can trace their ancestry back to the Igbos. And they talk a lot about the influence in terms of the drums, the rhythms in the Creole music and in the language. And then there's a lot of English, obviously, some Spanish words, goma, meaning hangover, coming from a Spanish word, bali or valido, meaning friend, and other African languages, Yoruba, a Creole word, kunku. Actually, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right at all, but that comes from Yoruba, konko, meaning very small or short. And then apparently, I've been told that there are a lot of words from the Mosquito Indians language.
And who are the Mosquito Indians?
The indigenous people from Central America. Actually, one interesting one I just thought I would mention was esclava. It comes from Spanish, but it means bracelet in Creole. And so the way that things have evolved, apparently it was sort of bracelets that slaves had whatever they were tied with became a meaning that's completely different from its original slave meaning.
Right, right. So the national anthem and the push to have this sort of alternative national anthem, the dictionary or maybe more than one dictionary, we don't know. Is this part of a big effort to legitimize Belizean Creole? Eventually, I guess, you know, have books and newspapers, et cetera, all operating in Belizean Creole.
Yeah, well, I don't know about all of them being in Belizean Creole. I mean, I met a number of people and I read the works of a number of people who feel very strongly that there should be offerings in all of those categories in Belizean Creole, but never that it should push out English, that it should be the only language, the only sort of main official language of the land. But it was interesting because I did read the argument in the preface to this dictionary by the Creole Council that it could actually improve people's English. And there's a lot of, I mean, what I found reading just the newspapers, there's a lot of sort of rough and differing understanding of what the formal English is, how the grammar should be. And I think partly it's just little things like a former British colony has a lot of American influence now. You find a lot more Americans there now than English. So there are different ideas of, you know, in England you might say a family are, and in the U.S. you say a family is. And I see a lot of confusion about the use of singular and plural, and it goes well beyond just the difference between the U.S. and U.K. So, yeah, I mean, it would be very interesting to see if people can read and write more Creole, if they can work on their English at the same time in a very sort of distinct way.
Right, code switch more easily.
Yeah, unfortunately, there is very little funding for education in Belize, period. And I think a statistic I read is that most people, or a lot of people, don't make it to eighth grade. And then parents have to pay for all their kids' materials. And then in high school, there isn't even free public high school available. So it would be sort of a hard test to see how successful a strong education in both languages would be.
Right. There has to be an argument for Belizean Creole that it's simply a wonderful neutral language that brings everybody together, that doesn't threaten anybody when it's spoken. It was not like, oh, that's English, the language of some colonialists or Spanish or, you know, what have you, outsider languages. This is very much a language that has sort of bubbled up as a result of history and is not owned by one ethnic group who lorded over another one. I mean, that must in a way bring people together.
Yeah, I think it really does. And it's very interesting because people like Lila Vernon talk about Creole culture. And when she talks about that, she's largely talking about people who were descendants of slaves and sometimes also descendants of slave masters. And she was a whole mix of Yucatec Mayan and Sierra Leonean and Jamaican and Irish. But actual people who sort of fall into that category of Creole only make up like 40% of the population, or now I think it's actually quite a bit less. A lot of them have left the country. But so a lot of the people who are speaking, the groups who are speaking Creole to each other have no connection to actually being Creole or considering themselves Creole. And there are three different Mayan linguistic groups in Belize, and they speak Creole to each other. And Ms. Vernon,
because they don't speak each other's languages.
Right. So Ms. Vernon was saying to me, actually, it's really interesting to hear Mayans speaking with Mayans in Creole because it's actually very different from what she's familiar with in terms of the language and the word choices. So it makes it very much theirs.
Right. Well, great stuff. Thanks very much, Amy.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Okay, that's it for this week, except for a little midnight snack to eat sideways. We're going with Igbo here. As we heard, one of those African languages you can find in Belizean Creole. And it's a first name for a boy. It is Numdi. That's double N at the beginning. And it means, my father is alive, when it was previously thought that he was a reincarnation of his grandfather. Now, if you can think of an English name that conveys that, let me know. You can find me on Twitter or Facebook or at theworld.org/language. And I'll be back, maybe, with Carol next week. It's all down to logistics. If I can't pile her and me into a studio at the same time, you'll have to put up with just me. Ta-ra for now.